Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
It is very important that they understand us well. They understand our cultures, they understand our way of life. They really appreciate who we are and what we stand for.
A Ugandan official says he looks forward to improve relations between Kampala and Washington this year.
The arch traveled to villages in Ethiopia, in India, and Zambia to understand the circumstances under which young girls were being forced into marriage.
The state funeral for Nobel Peace Prize laureate Archbishop Desmond Tutu takes place in Cape Town, South Africa.
ECOWAS also perhaps has itself to blame. ECOWAS appears to be standing by and allowing some leaders to tamper with the constitution.
And a national conference in Mali recommends a 6-month to 5-year transitional period before elections in the West African country. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda State Minister for Foreign Affairs as he looks forward to improve relations between Kampala and Washington this year. Okello Oryem says Uganda will continue to partner with the U.S. to stop security threats by militant groups who threaten the country and its neighbors in East Africa. The Ugandan official says, as in all relationships, there are occasional misunderstandings, but he says these are addressed as part of the process of strengthening ties between the two countries. Okello's remarks come after the U.S. recently imposed sanctions on Major General Abel Kandihu, Uganda's chief of military intelligence, over alleged human rights abuses. Speaking with me, Okello Oryem underscored the importance of close diplomatic relations between Kampala and Washington.
We've always been good friends with a cordial and solid relationship. And in spite of the occasional misunderstanding that the U.S. have of Uganda and the recent what we call unjustified sanctions against some of our officers, we continue remaining friends. The uniqueness in our friendship with the United States is that as friends, trusted friends, on all occasions, we do have misunderstandings. On all occasions, we disagree, but eventually we make up and continue being friends.
So looking forward to this year, what are your expectations about the relations between Kampala and Washington?
We need to consolidate this relationship. What is important about the United States and other partners should understand is that where else in their countries, for many years, every 4 years or less, there are frequent changes in people in administration, advisors, people in who are close to the Secretary of State in charge of Africa, people who are close to the Biden, there are normally changes. But it is very important that they understand us well. They understand our cultures, they understand our way of life. They really appreciate who we are and what we stand for. That is what makes our relationship stronger and better. But each time there's a change in administration, there are some individuals who come in the new administrations who, at the first sight, decide to take decisions and advise the leadership based on uninformed positions on Uganda and maybe on other African countries. So it's important for the United States of America that going forward in 2022, there's a need for a more comprehensive, in-depth understanding on the uniqueness of Africa, the uniqueness in the cultures and tradition of each country, the uniqueness in the values and the ways of life of Africans, and that is what will make our friendship continue to be strong and solid.
If there's a strain, like the recent sanctions imposed on some of the military officers of Uganda, how do you address the strain in order to strengthen the relationship or to smoothen the relationship between Kampala and Washington?
Well, what we do is that we express our views on what we think has caused the strained relationship. We raise our concerns about it, and then we try and inform the United States government and update them and educate them on our position so that they understand our position better. They understand what it is that we stand for, and there's the reasons why we continue in that channel or that way. And we think that is the best way for them, for us to move forward the relationship. The Americans, the Europeans, and other partners have to understand Africa better. But you cannot measure and you cannot judge us based on the standard that you is based on American ways of life and American values. It's impossible.
So talk to me about the partnership in the fight against terrorism in the East Africa region, the partnership between Washington and Kampala. And
the issue of the threat of terrorism to an American life and to a Ugandan life is no different. Both lives are valuable. And the threats are serious to Americans as well as they're serious to Ugandans. So when it comes to the issue of the fight against terrorism, we undertake full-time role to ensure that our intelligence services, our security forces are working around the clock to make sure that they neutralize those terrorists that are an immediate threat to our country and an immediate threat to any other partners of ours, irrespective of who they are. Because today they can be terrorists who threaten Americans, but we know that tomorrow they'll change their weapons against us. So for us, every terrorist, irrespective of who the threat is to, we will make sure we neutralize them.
So what is your final message to the people here in Washington, your partners?
Well, my message to Washington is that there is a need for you to understand us better. And only by understanding us better, appreciating us better, our values, our ways of life, and what it is that makes us tick, that will make and consolidate our relationship further.
Okello Oryem is Uganda's State Minister for Foreign Affairs. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. The state funeral for Nobel Peace Prize laureate Archbishop Desmond Tutu has taken place in Cape Town, South Africa, with only 100 mourners allowed inside St. George's Cathedral because of COVID-19 rules. The anti-apartheid hero and human rights activist who died December 26 at the age of 90 had been suffering with prostate cancer. For VOA, Vicky Stark reports from Cape Town, South Africa.
Desmond Tutu was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1984 for his campaign against apartheid, said he wanted the cheapest coffin, and he requested that money intended for flowers should instead be donated to good causes. The South African Broadcasting Corporation, airing his funeral Saturday in Cape Town, showed his widow, Leia Tutu, sitting in a wheelchair listening to the tributes to her famous husband. There was a televised message from the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, who said it was like a mouse giving a tribute to an elephant. He said most messages he's been receiving from people around the world say that when they were in the dark, Desmond Tutu brought light.
He never ceased to speak prophetically. He never ceased to speak powerfully. He never ceased to shed light. Many Nobel Prize winners' light fades with time. His grew brighter.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa gave the eulogy. He said among those Tutu spoke up for were the Palestinians and members of the LGBTQ plus community.
One of the causes that was dear to him and less well known to many of us was campaigning together with Her Royal Highness Mabel van Oranje, who is here with us today, against child marriage across the globe. I have learned how the Arch traveled to villages in Ethiopia, in India, and Zambia to understand the circumstances under which young girls were being forced into marriage. Such was his stamina. Such was his commitment.
Ramaphosa credited Tutu with being South Africa's spiritual father. He said the cleric, along with the country's first democratically elected president, Nelson Mandela, preached hope and forgiveness. Tutu chaired the Truth and Reconciliation Commission that sought to heal the victims and perpetrators of apartheid's atrocities. He coined the term Rainbow Nation, referring to people of all colors who lived in South Africa and of the beauty that could come after the storm. In recent years, Tutu was critical of South Africa's ruling party because of rampant crime and corruption in the country. Ramaphosa alluded to this.
There are times when he felt let down, and yet he never lost hope. The most fitting tribute we can pay to him, whoever and wherever we are, is to take up the cause of social justice for which he tirelessly campaigned throughout his life. Archbishop Tutu has left a formidable legacy, and we are enormously diminished by his passing.
Tutu's daughter, the Reverend Naomi Tutu, also addressed mourners.
Many of the messages we received have said, thank you for sharing him with the world. Well, it actually is a two-way street. Because we shared him with the world, you shared part of the love you held for him with us. And so we are thankful. And we are thankful that all of you have gathered in your many places, in person or via the wonders of technology, to be a part of celebrating Daddy's life throughout this week. And lastly, to him who has gathered us here, Udedi, Dada, we say thank you, Daddy, for the many ways you showed us love, for the many times you challenged us, for the many times you comforted us.
Archbishop Tutu is being cremated in a private ceremony, and his ashes will be interred in St. George's Anglican Cathedral. He's survived by his wife of 66 years, their 4 children and 9 grandchildren. Vicky Stark for VOA News, Cape Town.
In Mali, a just-concluded national conference recommends a 6-month to 5-year transitional period before elections are held in the West African country. The summit was organized by the military-dominated transitional government led by Colonel Assimi Goïta. The recommendation for the transition appears to clash with demands for a quick return to constitutional rule by regional bloc, the Economic Community of West African States, or ECOWAS. The group suspended Mali and imposed sanctions on the military following the August 2020 coup. Meanwhile, local reports say the recommendations of the national conference will soon be sent to officials of the ECOWAS Commission. For analysis of the latest development in Mali, I reached Paul Ijeme, an international affairs analyst and a former ECOWAS official.
So, it's actually a delay from what they had said they would do. They had talked about 18 months transition from last year when they took power. Remember the August 2020 coup. But what has happened, they are saying that they needed to do a lot of things, and that insecurity and other issues have made that timetable unrealizable. I think 5 years is a stretch. They're using that as a bargaining chip, that ECOWAS that is putting pressure on the military and then suspending Mali. We'll have to find a middle ground, you know, maybe talk about a year, 12 months to make sure that they go back to the barracks.
Brushing aside the ECOWAS demand for a 6-month transition and coming up with a roadmap between 6 months and 5 years, doesn't that pose a headache for ECOWAS to deal with, because then it doesn't serve as a deterrent?
ECOWAS also perhaps has itself to blame. ECOWAS appears to be standing by and allowing some leaders to tamper with the constitution or rig election, and then they don't rubber stamp that. People change constitutions to get tenure and ambition, and carrying out what some people have called a political and constitutional coup. And so we are saying that if the ECOWAS allows those leaders to do that, they don't have any justification for coming on the mess to rush them back to the palace.
So you mean ECOWAS might have to settle for a delay of the Mali political transition to a democratically elected government?
The alternative is to force Mali to hold an election. And I don't see that happening. Is ECOWAS going to send in troops? Well, knowing that Nigeria Thomas President Goodluck Jonathan is the chief mediator for ECOWAS on Mali, I think that would be the realistic thing to do, because to insist on the military leaving by 22nd of February 2022, this ECOWAS is being ignored. The Mali can actually say, well, you go, you know, block. And I don't think that is what ECOWAS will do. I think they have to negotiate.
So are you saying that ECOWAS has lost its edge and its influence with all these sanctions? Mali seemed to appear to have a little bit of a wiggle room to delay the transition imposed by ECOWAS, demanding that it organizes election within 6 months and hand over power?
You know, in life, you have to be pragmatic. And then also, you know, your body language and your action, rather, sometimes will speak louder than voice. When you keep insisting or not coming hard on the military when they act, well, you are not applying the same pressure on your colleagues, the leaders, the peer review. You tell your leaders, they were there when, for instance, Alpha Conde was changing the constitution. What did ECOWAS do until now the military struck? You cannot in one breath tell us to do something and then in another breath you are doing something else.
Does that mean that ECOWAS, by its action or inaction, might have contributed to what many people say are a democratic slide or retrogression in West Africa?
I think so. I would say that in the past 10 years, the leadership of that organization has not been as forthright, transparent, and then committed as in the previous time. Remember that this was the same ECOWAS that sent to ECOMOG, you know, the ceasefire monitoring group, that ended the civil wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone, and then even mediated in a crisis in Cote d'Ivoire, in Niger, in Guinea, and so on and so forth. And was when they imposed sanctions in those days, it was carried through. There are, you know, actions that do not add up, that leave ECOWAS vulnerable.
Paul Ijeme is an international affairs analyst and a former ECOWAS official. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Kenyan lawmakers brawled as they debated proposed changes to a law governing the conduct of political parties and the formation of coalitions ahead of the 2022 election. For VOA, Mohammed Yusuf reports from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
Video broadcasts on television showed lawmakers engaged in a shouting match and coming to blows as they fought over the measure. One member of parliament was seen with blood on his cheek, another was suspended. At issue is a bill that will guide political parties on how to conduct political affairs leading up to the election. If passed, the legislation will allow several parties to form a coalition and choose a presidential candidate. Political commentator Martin Andati says those behind the bill aim to use the constitution to force a political winning formula.
The handshake team, which is the president and the former prime minister, are basically trying to use a political route to find a way of getting the people who are not supporting them to agree to either go on their side or go on the Ruto side, so that they are able to draw up a political strategy.
Opponents of the bill, most supporting Deputy President William Ruto, see it as a plan by President Uhuru Kenyatta and opposition leader Raila Odinga to force the smaller parties to merge with them to win the election. Those against the measure introduced separate amendments, which critics say were meant to paralyze the parliamentary proceedings. Political expert Michael Agwanda says the proposed changes mean that lawmakers will have to be loyal to their parties.
Basically, what that means is that you are either part of government or you're not part of government by instrument, and that you cannot cross the other side unless you just decide to do that, but you'll not be part of that government if you do not belong to the coalition that makes the government.
The proposed changes will require the parties to form a coalition 4 months before the election, thereby blocking them from joining another coalition party. Agwanda says bigger parties are targeting the support of the smaller ones.
The incumbent upon the political parties now to decide which coalition they want to join, because that is key to either forming the next government or not. I think they're targeting the smaller parties to make a serious decision to support the big guys. They're also targeting parties like ANC. They're also targeting parties like Ford Kenya. And they know very well that they cannot make the next government. And so as a result, they're saying, you either belong to us or you don't. And if you don't, then you go to oblivion.
Kenyan politicians are fond of changing political sides to suit their interests, which analysts say has hurt the opposition. The sponsor of the bill, Amos Kimunya, said he has asked the parliament speaker for another meeting so the legislation can be wrapped up.
Let's keep up the spirit, because at the end of it all, what we are doing is for a better political party governance in this country as we deepen and widen our democracy for purposes of posterity.
The debate ended with members of parliament voting for 8 proposed changes out of 27. Parliament will reconvene in January to vote. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
The Africa Energy Chamber, a group that works with indigenous companies in Africa, has named 25 movers and shakers to watch this year in the energy sector. They include government ministers and other prominent persons who play a major role in the sector across Africa. Officials say the African Energy Chamber brings together government and legitimate businesses to help increase energy growth using international standard business practices. Ann Norman, president of the Sakara Energy, has been named as one of the top 25 influential people to watch this year. Her company develops and invests in gas projects that eliminate and monetize gas flares by using modular small-scale gas plants. For reaction to her nomination and what it means for her organization's work in Africa, I reached Ms. Ann Norman via Skype.
I was absolutely shocked because if you look at that list, it's an illustrious list, and one never thinks of themselves in any kind of circle with ministers of state and presidents and, you know, CEOs of large companies. So I was very honored. I was very shocked. I'm very pleased about it because I've been working very hard in this space that I focus on, small-scale gas projects, so flare reduction, almost exclusively, and almost exclusively in Africa, which includes North Africa. So I was happy. I'm happy and shocked.
What does this mean for you and your organization?
Well, Sakara Energy is a rather new organization. We've been around for about a year, and it came out of the last 6 years of my time running around Africa, mostly sub-Saharan Africa, but sometimes North Africa, to work on flare reduction projects. And what those mean is small scale. In the world of gas, you measure things by scf, by million cubic feet. And small scale is usually anything under 30 million or less. And above that is bigger gas, and other people are focused on that. And it's a market that is very much underserved, and the technology is very different than normal gas projects. So it means that there's some credibility and some focus from a continental perspective, but also from a global perspective, that these projects are very important. And the last year we saw COP, we saw all of the work in Scotland, we saw the IEA reports, I think the UN put out a special report on climate change, and one of the biggest and most notorious polluters in the world are flares off of oil wells. So the timing is right, and I think that's one of the reasons why there's focus on what I'm doing and what Sakarya Energy is doing, what our company is doing, to eliminate these flares and put them into production in local markets that we will serve.
So with these local markets that you serve, how has been the cooperation between the government, the oil companies, and your business?
Absolutely fantastic. I couldn't be more happy about the cooperation with government and with private sector, with the oil companies, and also with the local communities across the board. It's positive and it's fantastic. Why? Because it's absolutely something everyone needs.
Anne Norman is president of Sakarya Energy. She spoke with me from Utah, here in the U.S. This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impunka, and that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs and Music from our African collection. But first, I Am is a movie eligible for the 2022 Academy Award in the Live Action Short Film category. It was also nominated for the 2021 Student Academy Award in the category of Best Narrative Film from International Film Schools. The short film is about the special relationship between a woman and an android that she finds in the forest. It was written by Florence Hearn and directed by Jerry Huffman. The movie, which questions the ethics of robotics, is a female-led drama which premiered at the Cinequest Film Festival in California's Silicon Valley. Director Jeffrey Huffman says, I Am also won the HBO Max Best Short Film Award at Martha's Vineyard African American Film Festival in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. To learn more about the film, I reached Jeffrey Huffman in Germany via Skype. Jeffrey Huffman is the director of the movie I Am. He spoke with me from Germany.
I Am, as we say, is a sci-fi art house thriller with horror elements and thriller elements. This was our thesis movie. So I studied in Hamburg at the Hamburg Media School. And we have a collective of four, the screenwriter, the producer, the DP, and I. And we had a total different script. And then the pandemic came and we had to rearrange. And so this was kind of came out of an energy of what can we do to tell stories that matter to us. And yeah, it's Noé is 41, a black woman who is hiding in the woods. And on her daily, we are in a world in a near future of Germany. You don't know exactly what time it is. And on one of her daily throws, she finds a lifeless body, like a female lifeless body that looks like a puppet. And she figures out it's an android and she takes her with her. And then they have a strange and creepy relationship. That's to not give away too much. That's kind of the...
All right, so what will you say is the motivation behind this movie? Did the pandemic have anything to play with rewriting the script, as you said, when you decided, well, let's do this movie at this time?
100%. Also, it was not a rewriting, it was a complete crash because we had a total other story that had elderly people, like risk people, it had club scenes, it had a huge ensemble, and it was very, very early on where we were like, we're never going to shoot this, so let's find something new. And then there came this pure energy, which I think was artistically emotional valid, because it's like it's a global pandemic. Should we do at this time, being at an art school or being in a doing a film, doing art, is such a privilege, and you came across this for another, like on a much more emotional level. Shouldn't we go to the hospital? Shouldn't we do charitable work? Is it what are we really doing to help the world? And then it's much more at stake, I feel. And so for us, it was really important that we tell a story that we feel matter at this particular moment for all of us, that justifies that we spend this time while a lot of people are suffering. And so it had a lot to do with it. So there was this strength and energy of this is the story we're going to tell. Yes. In the German-speaking countries, there's such a lack of diversity for a long time. You don't see black women in the leads. You don't see black women in roles with racist narratives overall, you most of the time, there's a lack of having three-dimensional characters that don't talk about their skin color or their refugee history or their broken German and stuff. So for us, and especially for me, to just do a story where there's two strong female leads that in the near future of Germany, and you don't see any white person, and there's no question about it, was very emotional. Yes.
Jerry, you are doing something unique, since, as you said, you don't find movies in Germany with strong black leads. What is the message here?
The great thing, I think, for us as filmmakers is that these behind-the-scenes thoughts that I told you are not part of the story. So for me as a filmmaker, it's important that we have an inclusive, open industry that doesn't reject different body types, disabled people, transgender people, homosexual people, complex women, black people. So there's such a huge lack of so many bodies that we don't see in the European and especially German film industry. That is something that I want to do as a filmmaker. When you ask me for the message of the story, it's two women talking about value, because there's an android, like an AI, an artificial intelligence, that says, why can't I have the same rights as you? And I think this is something that is a question that we ask ourselves as a whole society, at least after Black Lives Matter movement, is the idea of who matters, and aren't we all human? And can we then not open it also to an artificial intelligence? What makes your life have value? And I think that's the biggest conceptual question. But of course, me as a filmmaker, I have a lot of different things that I want to do and that I want to include and that I want to make sure. And I come from acting. I'm an actor since 10 years in Germany. And so I have had a lot of experiences with very limited, the range of characters were sometimes very limited or racist or biased. And so I feel this need and urge to change. And I think for me, film it's about entertainment, but also it's a reflection of our everyday lives.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports. And for that, let's join Douglas in Puga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The 33rd Africa Cup of Nations kicks off in Cameroon on Sunday, January 9th, after being delayed by a year because of the coronavirus pandemic. Opening games are in Group A, where host Cameroon play Burkina Faso, while Ethiopia will play Cape Verde. The following day, on Monday, January 10th, in Group B, Senegal take on Zimbabwe as Guinea play Malawi. 3 years ago, Cameroon was knocked out in the round of 16, and now the hosts will have a goal of taking the continent's most coveted silverware for a sixth time. Meanwhile, international footballers will now be able to play for their clubs until January 3rd, before leaving for the Africa Cup of Nations, according to CAF. FIFA rules state that clubs had to release players on December 27th last year for the tournament, which starts on January 9th. But a letter from FIFA to the World Leagues Forum last week said the Confederation of African Football had agreed players can turn in official games for their clubs up to January 3rd. FIFA said the decision was taken in the spirit of goodwill and solidarity. So international stars like Liverpool's Mohamed Salah, Sadio Mane and Naby Keita can play for their club against Chelsea on Sunday, and Chelsea will have their sixth Senegalese keeper Edouard Mendy available. In athletics, Ethiopia's Ejegayehu Taye and Berihu Aregawi broke the world 5-kilometer records in Barcelona on Friday, clocking 14.19 and 12.49 respectively. The 21-year-old Taye had set an Ethiopian 3,000 meters record of 8 minutes 19.52 seconds earlier last year, and was the second fastest woman in the world over the 5,000 meters this season. But in Barcelona, she was contesting just the second international road race of her career. 20-year-old Aregawi, meanwhile, had come within 1 second of Joshua Cheptegei's world record in Lille in November, so was keen to take another crack at the mark before the year was out to ensure he could end 2021 on a high. With the women and men starting at the same time, Taye was able to use some of the men in the field as pacemakers. And Aregawi had a pacemaker for the first kilometer or so, but after that he was out on his own. The Diamond League 5,000 meter champion stormed through the finish line in 12.49, taking 2 seconds off Cheptegei's world record. Peter Maru was a distant runner-up in 13.30. And in cricket, India wrapped up a 113-run win over South Africa on day 5 of the first test at Centurion. Needing 305 to win, South Africa were bowled out for 191, with the final 3 wickets falling in 12 balls after the interval at SuperSport Park. And that's about it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sport. Nightline Africa Sports. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. It is appropriate to review the past as an indication of what we should look forward to in the future. Africa, like the rest of the international community, have been devastated by the pandemic, which we had hoped would have abated this year, but instead has been aggravated. Africa, too, has suffered from the devastating impact of the economic, social, and other developments that have set back the world community. In other areas, Africa, regrettably, has fallen into the bad habit of the 1960s and 70s of many coup d'etats. Of course, we cannot forget that we have been able to achieve peaceful transfer of power in countries like Zambia and Malawi. But we are also hoping to see more possibilities of the peaceful transfer of power next year. The most serious developments in the security and political field for the African people is the war in Ethiopia. Let me remind Africans that Ethiopia as an entity has a symbolic meaning for the continent. Who should forget the role of Emperor Haile Selassie, who challenged Italian aggression and had to remind the winning conference in Geneva that peace was undividable, a sad remembrance in terms of the devastation of the Second World War. So that war, but the war still going on, should not be allowed to end in the disintegration of Ethiopia. For next year, we must hope that the reporting of the war is balanced and that hopes for peace are negotiated without settling scores, and that the people's interests should be fundamental. So we look forward to what has just been announced by the government and Ethiopia, that it has no interest to enter territory of the TPLF, even though that territory is part of its territorial entity. Sudan remains a disappointment. The hopes of the past have been dashed, and recent days have shown that next year might be as troublesome unless the international community becomes more aware that transition governments are not intended to settle scores or to take advantages for this or that outside power. Transition governments have only one major function: to prepare a leveling playing field for free and fair elections so that the people who have been given the power to change course can decide for themselves what they want for their country. The war also in Mali seems to be deteriorating, but we have had occasion during this year to deal with that serious problem. Let me conclude by looking at the problem of the pandemic. People have complained, Africans have complained, of the inequity of the distribution of the vaccine. Yes, that's true. But Africans must come to the realization that over-dependence is not in their interest. One should prepare in the continent, the talents are there, but to cooperate with the wider international community, but that Africans themselves should put their shoulders to the wheel and see what they could do. South Africa has shown how it can contribute to the resolution of this problem. So next year, 2022, will be a challenge for Africa to try as best as they could to put their house in order and to seek to cooperate with the wider international community, but not to become too dependent on others. Because if they do, the questions and the problems we are facing with the pandemic will continue. And thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
No matter the way that I deal with you. this is awesome.
Free Nation. It's a 9-6, baby. Unachokipanda leo ndicho tachovuna kesho. Imeandikwa mwanaume kula kwa jasho. Najiuliza vinani kayona kesho. Chapa mwendo na ukilala hauna chako. Hivi uhuru wa kuongea kwenye nchi bado upo? Sija kuongea vitu kesho nkajikuta seto. Kuna viongozi wavuta bange wapo, mana wana maamuzi ya kifeko wapo. Walio misija kaya wapo, na waliochoka kusoma namba wapo. Kuna wasanii mateja wapo, na waliopoteza malinda wapo. Kuna radio na TV, naona vimesha poteza CV. Hakuna uhuru bari wala taarifa ya bari. Wanapidisha pidisha kuyokopa serikali. Samini nchina ndesho kwa kiki. Siasa inafunika muziki. Vigozi wanashinda na kukiki. Wanakumbea front page wauze kwenye gazeti. Nasikia kuna viongozi wamefoji vyeti. Wapo. Kuna mademu wanasagana. Wapo. Eti kuna vidume vinalelewa. Wapo. Sijasikia mnasema. Wapo. Kuna mastaa wanajiuza. Wapo. Wapenda bari za udaku kuliko kazi. Wapo. Eti kuna wasani wanarogana. Wapo. Sijasikia mnasema. Kiongozi mwenye busara anapokea ushauri. Anapokea mawazo wa kimbere kiburi. Ayo samani mheshimiwa, hivi unamjua Bashite? Hili ni jipu jipya toka Koromije. Imesha iba na usali, imesha tunga. Na kukabidhi sindano ya kulidunga. Daktari haogopi kubwa kidonda. Wesi dokta wa majipu. Tumbu hakuna kufunga. Kupa miofisi za watu hekume nayo ni kazi. Hakuna noma wanangu tupige kazi. Boda boda kazi. Bajaji kazi. Eti vipi kukaba nayo ni kazi. Nasikia kuna viongozi wamefoji vyeti. Wapo. Kuna mademu wanasagana. Wapo. Eti kuna vidume vinalelewa. Wapo. Sijasikia mnasema. Wapo. Efa ni wao piga manati. Yopo. Sita ya masai na mangati. Faya. Esharangona na super chef. Tumzi mekata na shiga shat. Samini nchina ndesho kwa kiki. Siasa inafunika muziki. Viongozi wanashinda na kukiki. Wanakumbea front page wauze kwenye gazeti. Kuna viongozi wavuta bange. Wapo. Mana wana maamuzi ya kifeko. Wapo. Walio misija kaya. Wapo. Na waliochoka kusoma namba. Wapo. Nasikia kuna viongozi wamefoji vyeti. Wapo. Kuna mademu wanasagana. Wapo. Eti kuna vidume vinalelewa. Wapo. Sijasikia mnasema. Wapo.
We mtu gani sasa? Utaki kushauliwa, utaki kukosolewa. Umelogwa wewe. Unajiona ndugu yake na Yesu eh? Wewe wanangu eh. Raundi mtanyoka kia Mungu. Naona kichaka pewa lungu. Are you awesome?
Hepa ni wao piga manati. Sita ya masai na mangati. Esa rangono na super shot. Kumzi mekata na shiga shot.
Chiopo.
They call me bad.
I woke up with a fear this morning, but I can taste you on the tip of my tongue.
Yeah.
Record on it.
what's in my brain. Baby, you take over me, boo. You make me dance in calypsos for you, my love. I will do anything. Baby, you know me, mama. I know go make you go so far. Baby, you know I love you like seriously. So baby, don't stop loving me. Oh, na 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 na.
That was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America in Washington. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor William Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Nicole Beckford, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, water may cover the footprint on the ground, but it does not cover the words of the mouth. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
And keep on for you. I go clean them for you. Design them for you. Till I make them for you. So I go day day for you. Spend them for you. And keep on for you.